I want to start by just getting a little poll. You know, right now, a lot of things you see on TV have to deal with your ancestry, your genetic testing, and all that. Just a little survey. How many of you have done that? Okay. We're not going to ask you to reveal anything. I'm just wondering, because, you know, it's all the rage to take, you know, the 23andMe and Ancestry.com and kind of figure out who's back there behind you contributing to your genetic makeup. And of course, on the front page all the time, right now we're dealing with the big controversy around Elizabeth Pocahontas Warren and her genetic testing and how that came out. And she was real excited when she found out she's 1/1024th Cherokee. Well, I want you to know there's a new test out. It's a theological genetic test. And what it can do, if you send in a sample, which I did, is you can find out what percentage of your salvation is because of God's election. And what percentage is free will. And I thought, wow, that's pretty good. So I took a swab, sent it in, got the results last night. Want to hear the results? Okay. I'm 50% elect. By the way, the test was called Elect Check. I'm 50% elect. I'm 49% free will. And I'm 1% Apache. So from now on, just call me Robert Noble Lewis. Okay? Anyway, great to be with you. I thought because of where we've been the last couple of weeks, Bill talking about how to invest in this next generation, and last week hearing about the generation we're investing in, I thought today I would take one aspect of this new generation and we'll experience together the world that they're experiencing from a spiritual standpoint. And to do that, I want to introduce you, if you've not heard stuff like this before, and if you have, it'll be a good summary about where we are in the global village when it comes to Christianity and other religions. We know they're around more and more. As you drive around town, you see different ethnicities dressed in certain ethnic garb, and you start realizing it's not the 1950s anymore, right? And the young people who've been growing up in that environment, because of all that they're hearing, usually from more of a superficial level, they come to certain conclusions about where they stand spiritually in regard to where the rest of the world is spiritually. And I think there are some prevailing myths that are so strong that it's hard to get even past the surface. And of course, you've got kids and grandkids, and sometimes it's good just to scratch the surface off all of this and see what's down there, because I think it kind of reveals where we are in the 21st century, really, as opposed to where people want to be. Because I think where we want to be spiritually in the millennial world is we just all want to get along and believe we kind of all believe the same thing, right? So let's start. I want you to look there on the notes. Those extensive notes are there for you to take home. I told Bill if I go long, I thought he sent out, by the way, an email to tell you to bring a sack lunch. But since he didn't, I'm going to try to cut it fairly short. So we're going to move real quick. If you don't want to take any notes, you don't have to. The notes will be on the email later. But let's just walk through it. I'm going to cover the six great religions of the world in 45 minutes. And therefore prove that I can do miracles. Okay? Here's some popular ideas about other religions. It's mainly held by younger people. Not so much us. Although I sometimes wonder if we would know how to explain why. But the three most popular are that all religions really are revelations of the same God. The sacred text across all the religious landscapes, the Torah, the Quran, the Bible, basically are all pointing to the same God. Even though, if you scratch just a little off the surface of that, what you find is below the surface of these great religions is they have wildly different viewpoints of God. Some believe, as we do, in one God. Some religions believe in no God. There is no God. Some believe in multiple gods. And then some believe that we are gods. And those are wildly conflicting when it comes to one another. And yet, on the surface level, it's easy to say, oh, we all are after the same God. The second myth is that all religions teach a similar moral code that at the core are basically the same. And there is some truth in that, because if you go through all the different religions, at least in a fractional point, when they're teaching about behavior, we do have a lot of overlap. Most religions teach that murder is wrong, you know, that you need to do good, not steal, those kind of things. And therefore, it's easy for a young person to conclude all those religions, they're basically at the core the same. But the truth is, if you scratch again beneath the surface, when it comes to moral overlap, that's a very fractional piece of what religions actually offer. That overlap is very small percentage-wise. I got a quote there by Ravi Zacharias, who simply says this: many say religions are fundamentally the same and only superficially different. But the truth is, religions are fundamentally different, wildly fundamentally different, and over only superficially the same. So those things about do good that we feel comforted in, that draw us all together from different religions, that's there, but it's all very, very small of what the religion actually presents and teaches. And then lastly, all religions are equally valid paths to God. And of course, Gandhi was the one that kind of got the Beatles going and everybody feeling like everything's the same pathway to God, because we all really are on the same road. They just are different roads that ultimately converge in the same place. But the truth is most of the major religions of history are very, very extensively exclusive. Christianity being at the top of the list. Jesus saying, I am the way, the truth, and life. I mean, this is hard to say in 21st century culture. No man comes to the Father but through me. Wow. That's taking a sword and just swinging through all the other religions. And yet, Islam says the same thing. Mormonism says the same. They're wildly exclusive in regards to one another. It's only those millennials standing on the outside with a lack of depth of understanding that looks just at the surface light and feels like, oh, we're all heading the same direction. But that's just not true. So let's take a quick flyby of just religions from the standpoint of where they are and where they're found in history. And you can jot this down or just listen. First of all, if you look at religions, their founder, the number of followers, Christianity stands at the top with Jesus at 2.2 billion people right now in the world. Secondly is Hinduism, which has no founder. We'll talk about that in just a moment. But it has 1 billion in the world. Buddhism, founded by a Siddhartha, has approximately now 487 million coming out of China. Judaism, with Abraham, 14 million, while Christianity is the largest major religion, Judaism is still the smallest major religion. Islam, with Muhammad, has 1.6 billion approximately at this time. And at least according to the experts surveying out in history, or surveying the future, by 2070, Islam will be the largest religion in the world. And it will become the largest religion in the world, not just because it's converting more people than Christianity is, but it's actually reproducing through childbearing more people than Christianity, because mainly the West and America, our fertility rates are plummeting. And with that will come a decrease in the number of followers of Jesus Christ, because there's just less followers being produced in homes. Mormonism, which is the modern major religion, Joseph Smith, has 14.8 million. And then just everybody else in a big lump, non-religious and atheists, the nuns, 1 billion. So that's how they fall out as far as numbers. Where they fit in history is this way on your little graph. The oldest known religions are two, Hinduism and Judaism, founded generally around 2000 BC. And you go, well, what was before that? Well, there's a lot of mystery before that, but there were probably still God-fearing worshipers of one God, like you see in Melchizedek in your Genesis account, where, you know, Abraham meets Melchizedek, and you get a little glimpse that, you know, religion and worship in Yahweh didn't start with just Abraham. It was been going on for, who knows, millennia before that, just not organized. And then there was also, just because of people populating the world, growing up in nature, there were all kinds of wildly idolatrous religions at that same time. But where we get it being formalized is in the two oldest religions, Judaism and Hinduism. And then in 530 BC, Siddhartha comes along, a wealthy Hindu who decides, this stuff isn't working for me, this Buddhism. And so he breaks off of Hinduism the way Jesus broke off of Judaism and forms another religion. Christianity being with Jesus and with Buddha or Siddhartha, he formed Buddhism off of Hinduism. And then Christianity comes along in 33 AD. Then 600 years later, a lot of people, this is one mistake, by the way, even we make when I talk to people in the church. They always think of Islam and Christianity starting around the same time. But it's important to note that Islam started 600 years after Christianity. And much of Muhammad's concept of God, concept of the Bible, and a lot of the parts of Islam is drawn out of Judaism and Christianity. And that's what helps form some of the core of the Islamic faith. And then, of course, later you have, in our day, 1830s, Mormonism, and then that brings us to where we are. Okay, so that just gives you a sense of how the religions fall out. Now, I'm going to move through each of these religions. We'll skip over maybe a couple, but move through them. And I just want to bring out some of the basic tenor of each one. And we'll start with Hinduism. And as you noted earlier, Hinduism has no founder. That's because Hinduism is really kind of a general term that we call today. The British actually came up with the term Hinduism when they ruled over India. To summarize the hundreds of different religions that had some connection to one another, but were also wildly different. And there were so many of them, because in Hinduism, and I read this, I still can't believe it, but I'll just tell you what I read, 330 million gods. Okay? And they are, they wildly different from one another. In their approach, in their beliefs, in who gods they draw off of. But it's so overwhelming, it just got the term Hinduism. And that's just for this general amalgamation of all these religions. Now, there are some things that connect Hindus together. Not very many, because in Hinduism, one Hindu can hold this faith that totally contradicts another Hindu holding this faith. One Hindu can have this god, another Hindu can have that god. One Hindu can be working his way to God, another Hindu can be trusting one of these gods that are not gods like we think of gods. They're more helpers to get him to the ultimate reality. And it doesn't matter that they go against one another. It doesn't matter they conflict with one another. What matters is they're all trying to escape the same painful reality to get to the eternal, you know, state. So that's what comprises Hinduism. Now, here's what they do believe. And this is kind of the simplistic core belief of Hinduism. They all believe that human beings are on what I call a wheel of life. And that wheel of life is filled with pain and suffering. And your job is to get off the wheel of reincarnation. Because if you don't do good enough or believe good enough or devote yourself good enough, you stay on the wheel. You just get reincarnated to another state. And you just stay on that wheel till you finally figure it out. And if you figure it out, then you spin off the wheel into Brahma, which is this impersonal eternity, where you return to the eternal absolute, where your personality and everything else is extinguished, but where you began as stardust. Ultimately, you go back to stardust. You become one of the glorious whole of our universe. And though you can't think or feel or anything, you're at home. That's the goal. Get off the wheel. Okay? And you say, well, what? When I get there, what am I going to experience? You're just going to experience nothingness. You're back at the hole. You're back. That's it. Now, that doesn't encourage me, per se. But we had a billion people who that does encourage, or at least they're trying, because they see this life as pain and suffering, and they're trying to get off the wheel. Okay? And that's what the whole focus of Hinduism is about. Now, if we were comparing Hinduism to Christianity, there are just some clear differences. I'll list those for you. For instance, with God, most Hindus don't believe in a personal God. They believe there are gods, lots of gods, but those gods are not like our God, some eternal God. They are a temporal God who serves as a helper to help you get to this Brahma eternity, this faceless, nameless eternity, like a drop of water, finally, you know, struggling in pain and suffering, but it finally drops into the ocean, and that just becomes ocean. That's the goal. When it comes to Jesus, they don't believe that Jesus is truly God, although when Jesus came along, hundreds of years after Hinduism was founded, they just incorporated Jesus as another helper. Man's nature, our self, is divine. We're not born evil, we're born divine. The goal is to get us back to the divine and out of this sinful state, or this painful state that we're in. Hindus see sin as an illusion. It's not something that has to be forgiven. It's just simply a lesser reality that we find ourselves in and we need to escape from. Now, generally, there are three ways you can escape, by the way. You can escape from the wheel either by doing enough good works or by knowing enough good things or having enough passion to the God that you're asking to help you get off the wheel. Those are the three ways you get off. Okay, and there's gods and symbols and rituals and all for each of those in this multi-religion to try to get you to Brahma. So salvation is something you have to earn to get off the wheel. Secondly, let's go to Buddhism. Buddhism, as I said, is an offshoot of Hinduism. You see a lot of it in China, of course. I've had the privilege of actually seeing it firsthand in China. But the founder was Siddhartha, and he saw all these multiple paths, multiple gods and stuff, the same way, by the way, Muhammad will see the same thing and reacted to it and said, this can't all be right. So he discarded his wealth and his family and went off in search of another way to get to this ultimate state of reality. And in the process of that, he came to a place where finally he just sat down and said, I'm going to sit here until I know how to get to enlightenment. And he did, it says, according to tradition, for 40 days. And at the end of 40 days, something happened to him and he became the enlightened one. He, in a sense, was able to touch this eternal state that he called nirvana, our word for heaven or eternity. He touched it and he became enlightened in how to get to it. And he said, I can show others how to get there. And so, because he was the enlightened one, his name changed from Siddhartha to the Buddha. So he's the Buddha, the enlightened one. And he got a cast of characters to join him, and then he established Buddhism as the religion, and then people followed the Buddha's ways to get to this eternal nirvana of enlightenment. Now, Buddha could not tell you what it's like to get there. He just can tell you what you need to do to get there. So again, it's kind of a mystery to get to this eternal state, although it too is impersonal. He rejected most of his Hinduism except reincarnation. Because Buddhism is a singular, rigid, works-based system to get to that enlightenment. And you do it, and if you don't do it good enough, then you come back as something else and you get to try again. So you're on the wheel. Has the same wheel, and you keep going, except it doesn't have multiple ways. Buddha said there's only one way. If you were with Buddha in the 6th century BC, you'd carry the one way, just like Christians later, one way to nirvana. And he explained it, how you do that, through his Eightfold Path of Enlightenment. If you look at your notes, if you go through it, you feel how rigid it is. If you're going to be an enlightened person and launch into nirvana, you've got to have right understanding, right thinking, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. Does that feel heavy? It is heavy. When I was in Beijing, we went to this celebrated play. It was almost like a Broadway play. It was spectacular in its imagery and its dancing and its message. But it was the path of Buddha. It was about a young man growing up in China who lived a wild life. He was introduced to the path of enlightenment. He tried real hard. The whole play is around him trying hard. And then ultimately he fails miserably. His life becomes a total disaster. He gives up on it for a while. But as he gets older and tastes the pain and suffering of his evil ways, a master comes along and kind of puts his arm around him and starts to begin to mentor him. And you see this change in this music and these great scenes and all that. And at the very end, he finally gets it. And you see him literally starting to rise off the stage. He's an older man now. And over in the corner, also lifted off the stage, is his mentor, who's now passed away in the nirvana. But this young man, now seasoned and changed through this rigid, disciplined life, he begins to lift off into the enlightenment. Now, Buddha could not tell you what he's lifting off into. He could only share with you how you get there. But that's Buddhism. And you go all through China and you see Buddhist temples. I went to a Buddhist temple and you see people, they were on holiday, a lot of business types there, burning incense and all that, you know, to try to get themselves aligned to rightness through their works. Okay, and how does it compare with Christianity? Well, in Christianity, you know, you have one supreme personal God, but in Buddhism, you know, there might be some gods that can help you, but they're just helpers. The ultimate quest is to nirvana, which is impersonal. Buddhists deny Jesus as God. They see him just as a good teacher. In salvation, Buddhism, the only person that can save you, listen, everybody look, only person going to save you is you. You are your salvation. You are your Savior. If you'll take on this eightfold pack and carry it until it becomes you, and you can deliver yourself off the wheel into eternity. As far as sin, Buddhists believe sin is just selfish desire, and that's what you've got to rid yourself from through this rigorous attention to detail. And then finally, eternity. There's no heaven or hell in Buddhism because when you die, you either just dissolve or you disappear into this great impersonal unknown. But if it's enlightenment, you've arrived. That's Buddhism. Judaism, I won't take a lot of time with. We know some of that. But what I do want to just tell you is that there's 14 million Jews today. They fall into two big categories, the secular and the religious. I'm not sure which is more, probably more secular. But in the religious side of Jews, there are four categories. And I've listed them there in your outline. They're the Orthodox Jews who still pay attention to Moses and the law of Moses and following what you would see in the Old Testament to be right with God. There's the conservative Jews who keep that belief system. They're not as rigorously attended to it. There are certain things they let go. They've kind of loosened the strings of the Mosaic law. There's the reform that we would call the liberal. They just generally believe in God, but Judaism is more of your ethnicity than it is your religion. And then there's the Messianic Jews, who are the ones who believe in Jesus as their Messiah. And those Messianic Jews are kind of newcomers to the historical scene. After the first century, they've kind of returned, you know, with Jews for Jesus and others. Those people are aggressively evangelistic. And because of that, there's a little statement I put in there. It's estimated that more Jews have put their faith in Jesus in the last 50 years than in the last 20 centuries. But it's come from Jews evangelizing Jews, okay, from the inside. But when you come to Judaism, if you have a Jewish friend and you're wondering, okay, what do they really believe? This will just summarize it for you. They believe a lot like we as Christians believe. They believe in one supreme God, but they don't believe that man is born sinful. They believe man is born free and innocent. And his life, what he scripts on his slate in his life, is the good and evil that he chooses to do. Jesus is, of course, not the Messiah. That's real clear. But the Orthodox Jews do believe a Messiah is coming. The more conservative Jews believe that the Messiah is more Israel as a nation. You know, they just kind of metaphorically change it from a person to a nation. As far as salvation, most Jews believe that following Yahweh and doing good is the way, that's why they keep the law, that's the way to salvation. Believe and work. That also is part of the rest of the Jewish tradition, even secular Jews. It's to be good. If there is a God, you just acknowledge Him and do the best you can. And they have a real optimistic view that God's going to be pretty liberal in His evaluations. But it's not just Jews who are going to heaven. They believe in a heaven and a hell. It's not just Jews who are going, but any person who believes in God and does good, God will look at that and be the judge. And because of that, if He determines you're good enough in your belief, then you get in. If He believes that you're not, then there's eternal punishment. So they believe in a heaven and hell based on belief in God, the one true God, and some good works. That only God then determines the outcome. You don't die as a Jew going, I'm assured of going to heaven. If you're a real practicing conservative Jew, you would think you are, okay? But you don't know. The final determiner of that is God Himself. Okay, and then Islam, which is a biggie in our world today. I told you Islam grew out of polytheism in the Arabian Peninsula where Saudi Arabia is. That's kind of the, you know, Saudi Arabia is big in the news today because of all that's going on there. But Saudi Arabia, just like which is going on since Muhammad, it's kind of the center point of a much rigorous conservative Islam. Regardless of how it's presented on the outside, it's kind of the core of that radical 6th century Islam that was birthed through Muhammad. And Muhammad was one who looked around in his day and he saw all this polytheism going on in the Arabian Peninsula. Also, Christianity was there and Judaism. He looked at all that and kind of like Siddhartha looking at Hinduism with all its gods, he was turned off by that. There was all kinds of compromise and syncretism and those kind of things. And so as he traveled back and forth and got exposed to Judaism and Christianity and all these things, he just thought this whole thing has gone to hell in a handbasket. That was kind of his conclusion, which I think was Siddhartha's conclusion about Hinduism. So he was in a cave. He went to a cave to meditate, and he was met by the angel Gabriel in his account. And the angel Gabriel dictated to him the Quran, which was to be the final holy book for man. And he came out of that cave convinced he had had those, shared it. Some people believed it. He was persecuted for a time, but after that time, he started building a following that went against the polytheism of Arabia. Remember, Islam means submission, whether you want to or not. So he began to press that. The people who didn't respond, he went to war with and killed and ultimately conquered all of Arabia and set up what we now know is the religion of Islam. So having done that, that gets spread all around the world. And so you ask, what does it take to become a Muslim? What's kind of the entry point? Ours is belief in Jesus, you know, believing Him, asking Him for forgiveness, trusting that He's given us back eternal life. For a Muslim, they have to work at it. And the work that they have to do in order to be a Muslim and be assured of their future is they have to practice what is known as the 5 pillars of the faith. That's the road to salvation. I've listed them for you, okay? Every Muslim has to publicly confess the Shahada, which is there is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is His prophet. And if you're around any Muslims today and they're talking about their faith, they will quote that even as they talk. Every time they mention Allah, or they'll say, blessed be His name, and they'll quote the Shahada, okay? Secondly, they have to pray 5 times a day pointed to Mecca, which Muhammad established as the most holy site on earth. They have to tithe 2.5% of their income. They have to fast during the month of Ramadan. You notice how all these are things you have to do. And then finally, they have to make a pilgrimage to Mecca, the Hajj. You see it on TV where they're going around the big black monolith and that kind of thing. They have to do that once in their lifetime, or they have to send a representative to represent them. And if they do that, that's their best assurance that Allah will look favorably on them when they die. But as any Muslim will tell you, if you ask them, are you assured that you're going to heaven when you die, or going to eternity when you die, they will do exactly what they have been taught, and that is, no one decides that but Allah. And until I'm there, I won't know if I'm getting there. The only really assurance that's given in the Quran of what we would call eternal security is for the martyr. The martyr is assured of some eternal state. And that's why, you know, from the beginning, to die for Islam is kind of, you finally get off the wheel. You know you're going to go. But otherwise, you hope you're going to go. And when I've talked to a Muslim and told them, well, I'm assured of going, they call what I just said cheap faith. They say, well, that's just cheap. You guys all have cheap faith. Okay, so how does that compare with Christianity? Well, here's how Islam and Christianity compare. Remember, there's a lot of overlap of Islam in the Quran. When you read it sometimes, as I have, you can find stuff you go, that's just taken right out of the Old Testament or part of the New Testament. And they use a lot of even New Testament symbols of the Trinity and other kind of things in the Quran. But if you compare them to one another, the Muslims just, they believe, as we do, that God is one, but they are absolutely vehement against the Trinity. They see that as polytheism. Remember, Muhammad grew up in a polytheistic culture, and anything that smacks of more than one God, you just get a huge reaction. And against Christianity is our belief in a Trinity, God the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. That, to them, that's polytheism. They are strict monotheists. When I was doing an archaeological dig in Israel, we lived in the city of Nazareth, which is primarily now a Muslim city. And there are all kinds of billboards around the town, but one of the biggest was right outside our hotel. And if you got out of the hotel, here's this giant billboard. It was quite large. And it was calling on Christians to renounce their polytheism and turn against the worship of God the Father, God the Son, and Mary. See, they think because it was a 6th century religion, they thought Christians worship Mary. Because remember, Mary worship was growing through the Catholic Church. And so their Trinity from their Quran is God the Father, God the Son, and Mary. And it was calling upon us to repent and come back to the one true God. That's Islam as far as how they view God. Man, they think man is born not evil, but he's born with a clean slate. He determines his destiny by his choices. Islam, of course, denies that Jesus is the Son of God, but they revere Jesus as one of the prophets of God. In fact, he's the second holiest prophet in all of Islam, and Muslims love to talk about Jesus. They just believe that Muhammad was the final prophet. And even though they will tell you they believe in the Old Testament, the New Testament, and whatever, they then will come back around and say, yeah, but Christians during the centuries corrupted those texts. So you can't use the Bible you have because it's all corrupted by Christians. We are the only ones that have the true understanding of what the Old Testament really said or the New Testament really said. When it comes to salvation, Muslims, of course, must earn their salvation by believing in Allah and following the 5 pillars of the faith. And then at the end, every person is going to be sent by Allah to either heaven or hell. And then this last one, we're almost done. I'm going to skip atheism, but this last one is Mormonism, which is the most interesting one to me. Because Mormonism is a recent religion with Joseph Smith, and he came on the scene and said that he received from an angel. It's interesting, they all get angels to give him, the angel Moroni, giving him these golden plates, and he was behind a curtain, and then he told the guy on the other side what the golden plates said and were written down, and then somehow the golden plates were lost. But that's where the Book of Mormon comes from. And of course, they've been in the news lately because they're trying to change their name back to the Church of the Latter-day Saints and not Mormons. But anyway, he got this information and then he began to propagate it around the United States, and now it's grown to really a worldwide religion. And in Mormonism, Mormons love and they've worked so hard to make Mormonism a part of Christianity. They so want them to blend together, and the idea that they would be called a cult of Christianity or not really what Christians believe to them is highly offensive. And Jesus has become higher and higher in Mormonism through the centuries, so that in Mormonism now his death and blood covers sin for the human race, just like in Christianity. They've made some alterations as their religion has evolved, and it has evolved over time. But they have differences nonetheless. And anybody who gets past the opening presentation at your door with a Mormon and would actually get involved with Mormonism, it's going to be wow. It's just going to be a wow. Because it is way, I'm not trying to be critical so much as I just want to, it's way out there. Okay? Because they believe everybody's a god. And you're on your way, if you do the right things, to becoming a god like God the Father. So they don't have this thought of, you know, a god who's the Father God. They don't believe in hell. They believe everybody's going to be saved at some level, although what you want to reach is the top heaven. You want to get to the celestial heaven. You don't want to find yourself in the terrestrial or the terrestrial. You want to get to the top. They believe in baptism of the dead to get relatives and stuff up out of one of those lower heavens to the upper heaven, kind of like Catholics with, you know, going to purgatory, get them out of purgatory into heaven. I want to stop there, and all I want to do is just give you just a little quick story of what I think is the most bizarre feature of Mormonism, just so you can feel it. So here's the way it would work. They have a wheel, but their wheel is not a wheel of pain and suffering. Their wheel is going from divine back to full godhood. That's their wheel. So here's how it starts. Every one of us in the room, we pre-existed as a spirit being. Okay? And how did we come into being? We came into being because someone who went through this wheel has gotten elevated to be a major god. And they're there because of how they've lived their life with their partner, because they've had a celestial marriage while they were on earth to a woman. So they're in heaven as gods, but as couples. Okay? So if you're married and you went through the temple and got a celestial marriage, that's forever. Okay? For some of you, that would be a great thing. For those of you, you'd go, I don't know. But they're there. They're there. And in their love relationship, they propagate spirit beings, which are us. And they're given a planet, and they send their pre-existent spirit children to Earth, and they become human. And while on Earth, they go through a process of trying to reach a first level of deity. And the ones who do it best are the ones who understand the teachings of Mormonism, Joseph Smith, the Book of Mormon. And they become Mormons, believing in the one true God, believing in Jesus, believing in the divine path to godhood, and hopefully finding a wonderful young woman that they can marry. And then they go to the temple and they take that marriage and they have a celestial marriage for eternity. And then they live out the rest of their life like Mitt Romney, because Mitt Romney is on this path. He's totally committed to it. And these are great people. I mean, they are great people. And they're going along, but now they've got their celestial marriage. And when they, lesser people of us who maybe didn't do that, we'll go into another heaven, a lower heaven. But for that couple, they die, and then they are taken into the celestial kingdom. And part of that celestial presentation is they get their own world. Okay? And they go to their own world, and in their celestial marriage propagate new spirit beings who then come to that world and go through the same process, hopefully producing more gods that can populate more planets, thus filling the whole universe with divine beings who follow after the one true God. That process is core to Mormonism, and it's called eternal progression. And that's what they believe. So in Mormonism, there is no one God. We're all gods. Jesus was just once a man, just like us. He was just like us. And in fact, they have a famous saying in Mormonism, as God once was, man now is. As God is now, man will be. So there's this progression to godhood. When it comes to who man is just a species of God, just at a different level of development. Salvation comes through Jesus. So everybody's saved, believer or non-believer, by Jesus, his blood. They've incorporated that into Mormonism. So we're all going to go to some heaven. But to get to the real heaven, it's through Mormon teachings. And as I said, Mormonism has those three heavens. And then the last thing. Bill, how am I doing? I'm doing okay, aren't I?
You're doing great.
I tried my best, folks. Okay, with atheism, I just want to point out with atheism the differences because, you know, we think of that atheism is growing in America today. The reality is atheism is not growing. That's a myth. What's growing is noncommittal spirituality. That's what's growing. That's what we were talking about last week with the nuns. We've talked about these are young people, many of them from Bible-believing churches who grow up, cast off their faith because for one reason or another, what they've got exposed to, they don't want to be pushed into a corner of one belief over against others because everybody really believes in the same God. All the roads are going to the same place. That's what they believe. And anything that says, no, some people are going to eliminate it to a millennial, that's not fair. That's not just. That's not the loving thing to do. So to keep the options open, I'll just become a nun. I'll just believe there are a lot of options out there, and I'll keep exploring them as I've rejected my maybe Christian upbringing until I find more enlightenment. And at some point, maybe I'll find something that really fits me the way I want it to be fitted to. That's the path most of our young people are on. And anything that seems to be unjust or unfair from my perspective, that thing has to go on the shelf, and I'll kind of observe it a little bit as I look at other things. That's the religion of America in the future. Is a non-committed observation and criticism of everything. I'm the law. I'm the judge. I'm the evaluator. And I want to keep my options open. Although what some researchers are telling us is that as millennials get older, they're haunted by the fact that there might be something out there. Okay? So they're not unspiritual. They're spiritual. They're just non-committed spiritualists. Atheism, of course, just says there is no God. The material world is all there is. Man is basically good. And the problem with man is he's just ignorant. The smarter he gets, the better he'll become. And I go, gosh, if I was an atheist just at that point, I just want to weep. Because the smartest people in our nation's history have done the vilest evil on the world. Salvation must come through reason. Jesus was just made famous by a myth, and this life is all there is. So, folks, that's just a quick fly-through of all those religions. I give that to you in the light of the series we're in for one reason. I just want you to know where a lot of your kids are and your grandkids and what they're going to be feeling and how important it is, just like we talked last week with the probe presentation. The best thing they can get is enough visual illustration from your life that maybe there really is, Christianity really is true, and then to have enough discussion that they can get below the surface of some of these religions and find out really what they teach. And let me tell you, if a millennial finds out what they really teach, they're going to pause because they're going to go, that's not, can't be right. So at least it'll give them a a spur to find out, well, maybe I may need to move forward on looking more into what Christianity is and how it compares with those, and then make a decision. Because at some point, you got to make a decision. Like Bob Dylan used to say, it may be the devil, or it may be the Lord, but you're going to choose somebody. Okay, let's finish up with this. Comparison in your notes between Christianity and other religions. It is interesting that when you put all the religions, if we could have them on kind of a desk here, one of the things that would separate religions would be in their belief system, but the real separation is around salvation. And when you think of that, you can put all the religions on one side of the table and Christianity on the other side of the table. And what makes it so unique is that one feature that Martin Luther shouted to the world in the 1500s. Man is saved by faith alone. Every other religion is a works-based, at the core. It's not that they don't believe in God, but the determiner is not their belief in God. It's how well I've lived out what I say I believe. And then God scores that, and you die not knowing if you passed. That's what separates Christianity from all the world religions that are more of a works-based system rather than what we proclaim so vehemently today in a glorious way. Ours is a grace-based system. Salvation in Christianity is guaranteed in this life. Salvation in other religions is not guaranteed in this life. Ours is established by a divine leader who rose from the grave. Every other religion, you can find them out there, their leaders are still in the grave. Jesus supported his teachings over and over again through miracles. If you look in other religions, there are very few, if any, miracles by their religious leaders. And when some are told to you, some of those miracles have been posted in after the establishment of their lives and their religion. For instance, with Muhammad, there are miracles with Muhammad that were done that came after he died, that then his followers, needing miracles to give proof text to him, wrote in. We don't know if they happened or not. They were written in after his life. Christianity is supported, this is the one I think is a really big one, by specific prophecies that any researcher can delve into, whereas in other religions, there's very little, if any, prophecy that tries to give a sense of assurance that God really is in control of history. And then lastly, Christianity, with God, he's close and personal. In every other religion, God is more distant and just observing as you live out your works-based lifestyle. So, final thoughts, then I'll turn it back to the master. First, the world's religions are at odds with one another in their primary beliefs and teachings and are therefore irreconcilable. Any half-wit who even scratches the surface of other religions will come to that conclusion. I'm not saying that in some callous way or insensitive way or against all these other committed people who are trying to find a way to God. But these religions are irreconcilable. There's no common ground of God or little, if any, common spiritual ground. The great religions are not just different, they are fundamentally opposed to one another. And they would tell you that. Their leaders would tell you that. It's the superficial population who wants us to just all get along. And listen, I wish we had that. I wish we had the Rodney King religion. Worldwide, we're just all going to get along. Because then we would. But that's not the way it is. It's much more serious than that. And the way it plays out opposes these groups to one another. So this to me is the bottom line. When one studies what great religions actually teach, you got to come to this conclusion. Either all of them are wrong, all of them, or one of them is right. Thanks very much.